On September 6, 2012, author Francis Kakagawa discussed From Memory to Memoir with Writer House board member Nika Waters.
I have to say it's really good that Rachel said that it's a conversation because I've never done an interview like this before. So bear with me if I mess up. You guys are feel free to laugh. I would love to hear from you. I write memoir as well. And you, Frances and I were just talking a little bit ago about, I was asking her about books that she's written and which one came first, kind of going in the order. And noticing the transition from the first one was, or not the first one, she said you had four books of poetry before any of these. But there's a... There seemed to be a lot on caregiving in here and poetry, but this is a Mosaic Moon, caregiving through poetry. And then it was Teacher, You Look Like a Horse, which I'm guessing is based on your year's teaching, third grade. and then it was Breaking the Silence, is that right? Then the two kind of kids' poetry books. And then Breaking the Silence, A Caregiver's Voice. So to me, it looks like a very wide range of different kinds and different audiences of writing. And can you talk a little, I know we're supposed to talk mostly about Kapoho, but can you talk a little bit about how you came to write these books and how you feel you've grown as a writer, or what the change has been in you?
All right, my first dream was to write the best-selling novel after I retired from teaching, but had an emotional experience while teaching, and so I began to write poetry. It was my therapy, and so I wrote four books of poetry, and they were published. And so I thought, I think I have a short life, because I was going to write the great novel after I retired, but the four books were published in my 30s, and I thought, I think I have a short life. But I was wrong. And so I thought that was over. I had my dream come true. Then my mother got Alzheimer's, and so I ran the writing support groups for caregivers, poetry writing support groups, because poetry became such an incredible tool to understand and make sense of caregiving. So this was a result of that. Then in the meantime, Teacher, You Look Like a Horse was always in my mind from the first day I taught, because the children were so magnificent that I said, someday I'm going to write a book about kids. So this is a result of that. So these books almost come to be written. Then Wordsworth the Poet. I've been writing poems since age 6, and there was a contest in Hawaii for children's stories. So I gathered some old poems and wrote a book, a story around them. So this is Wordsworth the Poet. And he's different, so people make fun of him. He's different because he's a poet. And I wanted this to be published. It won second prize in the contest. I said, oh no, not good enough. Put it away. Then there was a publisher who wanted to publish this. So we met over lunch. And I was so thrilled, my first children's book. But he called the waitress and he said, hey you, come here. And I thought, Wordsworth, he is so rude. We cannot let this man do you. Half of me said, go for it, your first children's book. Other part of me said, we both stand for human dignity. We cannot do this. So I was up all night. Next morning I called him and said, I want my manuscript back. And I took it back. 30 years later, the publisher and I were talking about this book ready to go to the printers. So I slowly took out the manuscript and I said, George, let me read you a story. And he wore a poker face. But he doesn't like it. He doesn't like this. After I finished the story, he said, that is wonderful. I want a whole series of Wordsworth books. So I immediately wrote Wordsworth Dances the Waltz. And in this, Grandma is beginning to lose her memory. And I wrote this more for adults, because they tend to separate children from caregiving. But I wrote this for adults in a children's book. And the theme of this is, if I can just read, see, Grandma. When Grandma hugged me, and said, "How's my words work?" When Grandma sent me presents on special days of the year. When Grandma gave me candy right before dinner time. When Grandma told me stories way past my bedtime. She was Grandma to me because she was Grandma. Not because she had a memory or because she knew my name. Now that she's losing her memory, she's still my Grandma, isn't she? So that's a theme of this. So that happened. Then I moved to Sacramento from Hawaii. I've been living there for 8 years, and I started a new support group in Sacramento for caregivers. So this is the result of my second and third support group. So it's a collection of our poetry on caregiving. So this came. While I was in Hawaii, and I'll tell you how Kapoho came to be written.
That would be great.
I'm monopolizing this whole
thing.
No,
that's the whole point. That's
it. Okay.
I want to hear from you.
Let's see. So Kapoho, I never thought these stories were significant because I grew up with these stories. Mm-hmm. When I moved to Sacramento and I would tell these stories, people would say, "You've got to write it down. You've got to write it down." So the first story, "The Enemy Wore My Face," begins with Pearl Harbor. And it ends with Kapoho being covered by a lava eruption, by a lava flow. And the stories in between are about my childhood growing up. And so this is a result of that.
And is this the most recent book?
That's the most recent. And in October, my third Wordsworth is coming out called Wordsworth Stop the Bulldozers.
And how many Wordsworth books do you think there will be?
There's two more. One has already been written, called Wordsworth Is in Your Pocket. And it's anti-technology, trying to bring children back to Earth again. And the fifth is in here, hopefully to be about world peace.
Okay, wow. Well, interesting to me, as you go, I have all kinds of notes, and I'll probably refer to them, and then I'll finish and we'll go home and I'll say, "Wow, I never asked that question that I really wanted to ask." But it feels like the poetry has been something to you. I mean, you use poetry throughout your memoir and here, and there are the one "In the Enemy Wore My Face," and I won't do it justice by reading it, but there's a It really touches you when you read it, how it felt for you to be taunted and spat at about your face in Japanese after Pearl Harbor. And I don't remember where I was going to go with that question. But the idea of poetry triggering memories and as a way of dealing with life as you have it comes out in Kapoho as well. How do you access poetry? How do you access the memories that are in this memoir? Because there are different types of memories that are in here. Mm-hmm. And a couple, one, is Keone a real individual or is that a made up?
I use that, it's a person that I know.
Okay.
And I try to bring in all the games we play into that story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because I was thinking it was also maybe a metaphor for what you almost weren't. Mm-hmm. If you had said, "Oh, it's only a dollar." The story that she writes is, let's see if I can find it in here. It's the, it's the Chisel, Kapoho story. Mm-hmm. And it's a man who's come back to Kapoho, which is covered in lava. There's nothing left of the town. And he, as he's walking through, memories come back to the surface. And he finds himself, he goes with the intention of selling this piece of land that had been his father's. And in the end, he doesn't. He can't sell it. But there's a piece in here, he says, the day he put away his dream of becoming a writer. And he puts away his dream of becoming a writer because he sold a poem for a dollar. And he says, "That's all I could get for it was a dollar." And his friends were saying, but look, you got a dollar. People were paying you for your writing." And he said, "What's the point of that? What can you get for a dollar? That's not where the money is." And he shoves the dollar back in his pocket. And so I was thinking that it was almost, you could have gone that way.
Yes.
And so,
I took some of the games with my childhood, and I thought about this person I know who loves money more than anything else. Mm-hmm. So I used his character to bring this out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish his children had seen that. in the end, his kid, you'll have to read it, but his kids don't get it. They don't understand in the end. So, I have to refer to my notes. Sorry. Go here. So one of the things that I do, I love writing setting and getting setting mm-hmm. straight in all kinds of visual details, but also in the emotional details. And I know for me, even though you write it in the first line, when I finished reading the book, I went to the Atlas to find out where Kapoho was, because I wanted to look it up and see where it was. And there's the big island of Hawaii, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I looked at the Atlas today, so I hope I'm right. The big island of Hawaii is the farthest kind of eastern, in the chain of islands that is Hawaii, the farthest east mm-hmm. is the big island of Hawaii. Pearl Harbor is about three islands back west from there. And Kapoho was a little village on the eastern tip. Hawaii kind of comes from my perspective. I'll see if I can draw it for you really badly. But like a little nose sticking out on the eastern tip. And that's where Kapoho mm-hmm. was. And tell everybody what happened. I mean, they can get an idea, Memoir of a Modern Pompeii. You can get an idea from that. But what happened in...
About the eruption?
Yeah, in 1960s, excuse me, yes.
Okay. It was in 1955, the first eruption.
Okay.
I was a freshman in college, and Kilauea erupted, and the lava flow came toward Kapoho and eventually covered the village, part of it. And we evacuated, we stayed away for a year, and the Red Cross, they opened up state land, and we bought our property 7 miles away. And the Red Cross helped to take a few of our houses out. Most of them were covered by lava. So,
Wow.
May I read them about my grandmother?
Yes, please
I'm going to read you about my grandmother.
Please do.
We believed in Goddess Pele, the fire goddess in Hawaii. Fire goddess Pele was venturing out in a creek like spilled molasses toward the village of Kapoho, a small, quiet, peaceful plantation village 30 miles east of Hilo. A pungent, rotten egg-like sulfur stench combined with the smell of burning wood floated over Kapoho on gray wisps of smoke, raining black ash over cars, over rooftops, and on windows. The village, like dice in a gambler's hand, shook and rattled. The lava flow burned everything in its path, slowly and with excruciating efficiency, sugarcane, ohia, and guava trees, feeding its red, hungry mouth as it crept toward Kapoho. My grandmother's house, a lone sentry a few miles from the village, stood next in line. And her house was one of the first to be covered by the eruption.
It's so far from my own experience, it's hard to imagine what that must have been like. And then you talk in a little further on about another eruption that comes and you're being asked to evacuate mm-hmm. again, and your family's saying there's no way, it can't take us again, it can't do this again. And I would imagine that I would feel the same way. I can't fathom it happening once. Like, there's no way it could possibly ever happen twice.
But in our culture, there's such a mixture of culture, and one of the strongest is the Hawaiian-based culture. So we truly respect Goddess Pele in awe, and I think even in fear. So when we were evacuated, and on the radio they would give misinformation, and at one point they said the next house to go was that of Sadame Kakugawa, which was my father's name. And he looked out in panic and he said, "That's not me, is it? That's not me, is it?" And I really got scared that his mind was cracking like what the earthquakes were doing. And then he looked at us and he said, if Pele wants my house, she can have it. So that we all turned into philosophers because of our belief and fear of Pele. We always called her Madam Pele. You know, like, called her Madam. We don't want her to respond against us. You know, we had to be in good graces with her. So.
And that comment, for some reason, makes me think of the different ways that you and your parents and your grandparents talked about the Emperor of Japan. The different, I hadn't realized that there were different terms for Japanese-born, first-generation American-born, and second-generation American-born. I'd known about the Issei and the Nisei, but I'd never known about the sunset. I never knew that there was a third. Does it continue on?
Yes.
Are there more terms?
So I am a sansei. I'm a third generation Japanese.
Okay. But you talk about the emperor and how the emperor is referred to, and there's again a poem that you have in the back where you talk about the how the different generations refer to the emperor, and your mother would get mad at you when you didn't give him the proper deference, and somehow that rang similarly to the you're talking about Madame Pele.
That's right, the same respect. And I think it was very difficult for my grandparents after Pearl Harbor, because their country became the enemy. I'm going to read that poem, may I?
Yes.
This is on December 7th. Under the rising sun, the enemy came, wearing my face. My face changed forever that Sunday afternoon. Home was Kapoho, a little plantation village near the eastern tip of the Big Island of Hawaii. Our town was built on the east rift zone of Kilauea, the island's most active volcano. Radios ran on batteries, telephones were almost non-existent, and a few of us read the only newspaper on the island, the Hilo Tribune Herald. So whatever news caught up with us couldn't be of much consequence. We were always seeing yesterday's news today. That particular Sunday, however, changed everything. Mr. Ito was listening to his radio. Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, he shouted. Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. I want to do excerpts. Turn the radio on, turn the radio on. Everyone stood in front of the radio, shouting above the crackling voice of the announcer. Are you sure? He said Japan. Where's Pearl Harbor? This means trouble. This means trouble. This means war. Are you sure? He said Japan. That was the day I learned to be afraid. That was the day I learned that there was an enemy who would wear my face, an enemy who would not be forgotten nor forgiven in the years to come. Shame, humiliation, and a host of confused thoughts would now become my shadow. I would hear Jeff for the first time. We were Americans. I knew that. We were fighting the same enemy. I knew that too. The face that I saw in the mirror looked American to me, and I had no reason to believe up to then that anyone else saw anything different. The day Mr. Ito went running around the village with the news was the day my face no longer belonged to me. A year after Pearl Harbor, I walked 3 miles to school, and this is what I would hear. Ajap. Ajap. It claws my spine, tearing skin. It enters my body to devour who I am. I spit it out, bullseye. So what do you do with Ajap on your face?
There's so much in there. There's so much in what you read. The one line that to me was very telling of setting in so many different ways was, where's Pearl Harbor? Because we think it's so easy. Pearl Harbor is kind of on the tip of our tongues. We know generally where it is. It's hard to imagine that you lived in the same general area and had no idea where it was.
Clue.
But it that brought a lot. Just that one line brought so much home to me about your setting and your little town and the just the whole background of all that. So, and the world probably didn't know where Pearl Harbor was before it was bombed anyway. But how did you choose these stories? Much like books of poetry, I would imagine you probably have tons to choose from.
I wrote a lot, and I had to
just
a few to the theme of the book, which was just growing up, the child part. And there were others after I grew up, but I left those out. I tried to end it right at the end of age, in college years. Mm-hmm. And it was difficult because there were so many stories to tell.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. And have you heard from people, family members, or people from Kapoho who have read the book, and they've come to you and they said, now, Francis, or Hideko is probably what they would say. Uh-huh. No, you got the story wrong. You need to tell it this way. Has anybody come and talked to you about that?
I changed the names of people, except for my family and my neighbors. And I was afraid because that was when the help was out, too. And all the lawsuits. But I said, no, that's okay. This is the truth as I saw it as a child. So I can't go wrong with the truth. So fortunately, it's been received so positively. And I think it's because ever since I had my first four books published, the residents have been very proud of me, that like I'm part of them. And so they all come to my book signings, and they're very proud of me. But there is a new Kapoho now. There are many mainlanders who went down to Kapoho and bought all the beach lots. And they also bought some of the house lots in Kapoho. And they all came out too. And they said, we live in a place we know nothing about. And you made this place real for us. So they thanked me. And that they will honor it. And so they have. They said, we have put gates up where no one can go to the beach through our property. And two families said, we have taken those gates down. We would like to honor what was Kapoho before. So there's some nice things going on.
That's great. You have a line on page 105, which I wrote down, but I want to copy it. Hideko still appears at many of my book signings and lectures. When I hear Hideko remember me, I look for a Kapoho face. At funeral services for someone from Kapoho, past residents will attend merely because it's a Kapoho funeral. Stronger than any Kilauea magma is this humanity of ours, holding on to a place that no longer exists except in her people. And it seems that new residents of Kapoho are hearing that.
Yes.
And they don't want it to be a place that only exists in her
yes.
people. They
mm-hmm.
want it to be a place that mm-hmm. exists for people now and not mm-hmm. just in the past. So that's lovely. I was going to ask, because
yes.
I had read
uh-huh.
that Kapoho is now a sort of a hoity-toity, upscale vacation
yes. it's all vacation
home,
land.
And it's kind of a big difference from what it was, mm-hmm. at least the stories of a
yes.
small-town village. In here, and so how nice that people, so often vacationers want to come to a place and turn it into their own vision of what it ought to be, as opposed to honoring the past, and how nice that
yes,
some,
that we will honor this land.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Okay, I have to go back to my cheating here again, but I know one of the questions in some of the memoir, the creative nonfiction classes that I've taken, as we talk about the contrast and the conflict between memory and memoir,
mm-hmm.
and how you remember things and how it comes across
mm-hmm.
on the page. And one story in here you talk about when you were the kidnapped emperor, the emperor's kidnapped daughter, and you
mm-hmm.
had the shoeboxes full of your past memories.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all were
left behind.
They were left behind.
Mm-hmm.
How did that make you feel? How did you... I mean, when you lose those pages and those pieces of real memory that are easy to look at and see, do you feel that, I don't know, how did you feel about that? As a writer?
No matter how negative things happen, I always say, they will make a good story. So, everything became... My dream to become a writer started when I was 6 years old, because we were poor. So the first book I held in my hand was a reader from Dick and Jane. Mm-hmm. And we grew up speaking pidgin. So here is a book that the characters did not speak as I did, because I was speaking pidgin. Then a teacher read a poem one day. This is when I was in first grade. And I could envision flowers talking to each other, and lips and lipstick and eyelashes. And I thought, wow, I want to be a writer. I want to be a writer too. So I held on to that dream. And so I knew then, and I have a story in here, how I tried to speak better English. And that's like being Wordsworth, who's different. People make fun of you. Like, don't try to be who you're not. But that dream was so big with me. So like things being lost, or the treatment after Pearl Harbor, or anything negative, my dream to become a writer became a real, like a tool for forgiveness. And kind of rebellious too. Like I would say, that's okay. Someday I'm going to be a writer. And you'll be standing in line to buy my book. So kind of a rebellious nature. But I thought, like, first year of teaching, I go into the classroom and all the old timers have taken all the supplies, all the books, and I have nothing. And I said, that's okay. Someday, I'm going to be a writer, and you'll be waiting in line. And a few times it has happened. It became a good forgiving tool.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you speak in here of a number of times where people helped you up. They didn't necessarily steal all your supplies. Mm-hmm. You talk about Sammy, your friend,
who
always wanted to boost you up, mm-hmm. and the tutor at the English Center, suggested that you mm-hmm. come back, mm-hmm. and then he taught you how to speak in a Southern mm-hmm. accent. But so that idea of not forgiveness, but of looking to see what can help you go up seems to also be another theme throughout mm-hmm. here is... How do you make it better? But it's we've talked a lot. You wanted to read a couple things from other books, or even some other pieces from here, and I wanted to give time for questions from the audience. I have lots more questions that I could ask, I don't need to go there. So
okay, I'm just going to read about Dead Poets Alive. It was the dead who kept me alive during all those years growing up, confined in a village so isolated, the only communication lines, an unpaved road sans cars, a battery-run radio, 3 community telephones. It was the dead who took me beyond the catalogs of Sears and Montgomery Ward, dream makers of the remote village, when one day I discovered an oracle within the pages of poets long gone, promising a wondrous world for the me not yet formed. Memorizing lines from Thanatopsis, reciting Poe's Annabel Lee, aching with Elizabeth Barrett Browning's How Do I Love Thee, dreaming in isolation with Emily Dickinson. Yes, yes, I said. Believing in Sarah Teasdale's Life Has Loveliness to Sell. Impatient to meet those 2 roads diverge, knowing I could not travel both. Fantasizing sinking 1,000 ships and becoming a phantom in delight. Made me wish for 2 mornings a day. Yes, it was the dead who gave me dreams, forming the woman I would become long before I became. But oh, how I wandered, lonely as a cloud. Shall I add a little flair?
I think so.
Okay.
Add more. You're layering.
I'd like to
you're
read
layering.
One from my. It appears in 2 of my caregiving. So one morning I walked into my mother's bathroom, and I see BM on the floor. And in that moment of panic, I picked up the smallest brush I could find, which was my own toothbrush. So here I am on my hands and knees and I'm scrubbing BM off the floor with my toothbrush with a glass of water in my other. And I thought my friends could see me now, they would be laughing. I also said, maybe there's a poem here. And the moment I said that, I was no longer a poor caregiver scrubbing BM off the floor. I was a poet caregiver. And that made all the difference. And this was what, this happened throughout my all my years of caregiving, that how can something as devastating as caring for someone losing their own, themselves, would become a great rich source for the arts. And for me, it was the poem. So I'm going to read the poem, and I'm going to, I have to get a prop for that. Okay, I need a feather ball. There we go. Okay, and I think I'm going to stand and read this. Whoops. A feather boa and a toothbrush. It is 3 a.m. I am on my hands and knees with toothbrush in one hand, a glass of hot tap water in my other, scrubbing BM off my mother's bathroom floor. Before a flicker of self-pity can set in, a vivid image enters my mind. An image of a scarlet feather boa, impossibly bought for Neiman Marcus, delicately wrapped in white tissue, awaiting in my cedar chest for some enchanted evening. The contrast between my illusional lifestyle of feather boas, opium perfume, and black velvet, and my own reality of toothbrushes, bathroom tiles, and BM at 3 a.m. overwhelms me with silent laughter.
There are so many conversations that could continue from that. The idea of turning what for so many people would be a almost untenable situation of caring for a loved one into a source for your art and a source for beautiful flair and laughter. But do people in the audience have questions for you? Because you're here to... Yes.
I have a question. You know, we all get older, and hopefully we all get wiser, and I think it's really easy to forget what we used to not know and how naive or ignorant we once were. So when you're writing this book, did you have a process to put yourself back there? Because it seems like one of the cool things is your youthful voice, not knowing so many things that of course you know now. So how did you get yourself back to where you were when you were?
Good question, because that is the most difficult part of writing, that I don't go into the story. I'm writing about a 5-year-old. I had to work consciously that I don't get into the story. I let the story tell itself. Let the story evolve. And so to get my narrative voice out of that story, and that was really difficult. So sometimes I'm saying, oh, I'm telling the story. Get out of it. And let the story evolve. Mm-hmm. And let the story tell the story. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And sometimes we underestimate the reader. So we say, I want to be sure the reader gets this. And so our narrative goes in. But you respect the reader long enough to let them know you don't have to spell everything out to the reader. Respect them enough. And so I think one of the best advice I got was from Mark Arix. He was an LA journalist. And when I showed him a few of my words, he would say, do you need that last line? Because I have that on my wall. Do you need that last line? That means over talking.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Yes.
When you're writing memoirs and you're writing caregiving, you're writing about real people and you're writing about very intimate events. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with the privacy issues?
I believe that, and I say this in all my workshops, the moment we begin to censor, our writing will be half-baked. It won't be as powerful. So if you want to truly be a powerful writer, we cannot censor truth. And it's worked. And many times, too, instead of saying I, you can put it in a third person to present your true story. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
I'm curious. You said that people in the village and your family members had a great deal of respect for Madame Pele, and said, okay, if she wants our town, she can take our town. Did your family or other people in your town go the next step about why she chose this town?
Yes.
I'm curious.
My grandmother's house was the first to go.
Yeah, I was curious.
She got no sympathy because they said, your grandmother... Okay, there's a legend that Madame Pele transforms herself into a beautiful Hawaiian woman, and she has a white dog. And many times she would visit homes asking for water, and if you don't give it to her, you will be, you know, punished by her. And I think it was a way of teaching us to be generous. And so they said, your grandma, I think, didn't give Pele some of her fruits. So this is why her house was the first to go. And so when you look at Kapoho, and there were certain homes that were left, those were the ones in good terms with Pele. But then those stories were told by those whose homes were sacked. But yes.
Did she feel responsible for that? Did she take it seriously?
No. In the Japanese, there are two words we grew up with. One is shikataganai. Shikataganai means it cannot be helped. So you accept it. And that's very powerful in our culture. And the other is gamang. Gamang is buried in silence. And so we never discuss any of those things. But shikataganai and gamang. So culture plays such a powerful role. Anyone else? Questions?
Yeah, questions are interesting to all of us, of course, but I'm particularly interested in your tales of Hawaii and hearing about the Big Island. I'm wondering, are there still small villages like Kapoho where I'm gathering your village was very homogenous, just Japanese?
No, we had a mixture of
It was a mixture.
No, yeah. Hawaiians, Filipinos, you know, as they imported the plantation workers, they were all there.
Okay.
So we had the entire mixture of ethnic groups. This is why our pidgin arrived from those languages. So we spoke in our pidgin, we have Japanese, Hawaiian, Filipino, all in our pidgin English.
Okay. Well, that actually matches more of what I remember of Hawaii, because I actually went to kindergarten, first and second grade, on Hickam Air Force Base, and my kindergarten teacher was Filipino, my first grade teacher was Japanese, and my third grade teacher
was
Polynesian, and so I'm curious to know how, and of course I have only childhood memories of Hawaii as well, because we moved after I was eight, and so I'm interested in comparing your memories of Hawaii that are different than mine, obviously, but also still very childlike.
That's right.
So it's fascinating to hear that. But I understand Hawaii is a very diverse place now.
It is.
Japanese reaction is, from what you know...
We never really noticed. It's very strange because we all... I never thought of being that I was truly Japanese in Hawaii.
Okay.
Because we all live together.
Sure.
Of course, there are prejudices like anywhere else. You know, I'm not saying it's a perfect place. But after I moved to California, I was reminded so often that I was Japanese. So in this book, too, in how we... I wanted the title to be The Enemy Wore My Face. But the publisher said, would be too political. It's not going to work. Others said, some of my editors said, they wanted, I have a story about my parents' marriage. It's called One Chopstick Marriage. Yeah. And I said, no, that's too Asian, too Japanese. No one's going to buy that book. So we settled for Kapoho.
And what does Kapoho mean?
It's, let's see, oh, I knew what Kapoho meant. It slips my mind.
Okay. So that story that you mentioned, the one chopstick marriage, the was one of my favorites.
Oh, really?
It was that one and the chisel story. Those were two of my favorites. And I think I love part of what I really enjoyed with it. When I'm writing or when I'm talking, I love to think about how things come up, and both those stories seem to explore that when you're. And the ice fishing one was the other one where you're going through something and something triggers a memory and then you fall back into that memory, and that you do that beautifully in those stories. But I think that's one of the reasons that I was particularly drawn to those three was it does that. I'm walking along and, you know, I hit my elbow and then it reminds me of the time that I fell, and then there's that whole other story that goes with it. But it made me wonder how some of these other stories came up for you. And how, I mean, you said you had a lot of them and you were picking through and trying to keep it with the theme of this, but I would imagine that something had to have triggered almost each one of these stories.
The first book, The Enemy War on My Face, I wrote that in the 80s and was published in a literary magazine. And later it was used in a documentary by PBS, and some of my poetry is in there. But You Think You Howling, that talks about my struggles to try to speak standard English so I could become a writer. And so I could leave Kapova and go to New York City and go to Hollywood to become a star. The Kindergarten Dropout, that was fun, where I went to school for just one day and I dropped out. And Speaker of the House, first grade experiences. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that's significant here? The others were, I guess these were stories I told, and there was you should write that, so I would develop them. Mm-hmm. Any of these. But Kapova was the most difficult for me to write, because the others came to be written, so I enjoyed, okay, I'm writing a story, that's easy. Kapova, the publisher said, why don't you write a story of Kapova? It's never been written. So I had to struggle with this. And editing, I learned so much about editing only with my Kapova story, because I found out that it makes a difference according to the gender of the editor, age of the editor, and the kind of writing they do, because they will bring their own writing style, their own gender, their, you know, how they view things to your editing. So I listened to all, and those who will write for you and say this should be written, I ignore. I just say, what are they saying? Does this fit when I write it in my own style of writing? Because this is my voice, not the editor. So you really need to be cautious of my editors try to rewrite your work. Always try to make it your own.
I have a question about the form. Rather than some memoirs are a whole book about one incident, or you might have somebody's whole life story, and this is almost like, this is like a story collection or an essay collection. Did you think about different ways to do this, or was it always a collection of stories?
I wanted to avoid this. I didn't want this to be only about me. It would be so boring and so egotistical. So I cannot do only I, and me. I needed to bring in characters aside from myself, and characters who were more of interest than of me. So people love Mrs. Honda, Mrs. Honda's daughter, so I tried to not make it only about me. So that's the reason I have a collection.
I like Sammy too.
Sammy.
The toes.
Oh, the toes. The toes, yes.
Are there other questions?
I want to talk about the mixture of poetry and prose. Do certain things occur to you in verse, or do you think some things in verse, or do you say this would go better in verse, or what?
I find it easier to write poetry. Mm-hmm. I struggle with narrative. Maybe it's because of my language background. Pigeon is very brief. And so I'm not a descriptive writer. I struggle with that. And poetry is so much easier. And I think it's close to pigeon.
but we say, you going, I going, we don't say, where are you going? It's very brief and pigeon. And so I think that is the root of my poetry, very brief and haiku-ish.
Do you think in poetry and translation, it's prose?
I find it easy sometimes when I'm writing, and I think, oh, I could do it easier in poetry, so I stick to poetry. But when I did The Enemy War on My Face initially, and all the English professors said, you cannot mix narrative and poetry, but I did, and they said, by golly, she did it. So.
Boethius did in the 6th century.
Thank you.
I'll let you end. But it's interesting to me that you try so hard, and you have a couple of stories about trying to overcome your pigeon because you felt like you couldn't teach and you couldn't write with that. Yet poetry is closest to pigeon, and that's an art form that many of us find very difficult. And I just find that the contrast between wanting to get beyond pigeon or out of pigeon somehow, yet your poems are beautiful and very descriptive and your language is wonderful. And it's interesting to me that you were trying to escape from something that now you feel forms or helps inform some of your poetry.
And return to where I began.
That's it. It's all a circle, isn't it?
Round circle.
Yes, do you want to end? I don't want to end with me. Why don't you end with...
I'll go read a poem one here. I'll just read a poem. Okay. Let's see. You take another.
Which one?
Okay.
The one I don't have is the dance, the waltz. No.
Do you have Mosaic Moon?
I do.
Okay, I'll do this. I think I have it. Let's see. Let me just get organized here. Poet, where did I find it? Okay.
Oh, there's is your copy.
Oh, there it is. A poet's declaration. I am a star in the Milky Way. I am the crest on emerald waves. I am a dewdrop, crystal clear, capturing sunbeams in the morning mist. I am that dust on butterfly wings. I am that song of a thousand strings. I am that teardrop you have kissed. I am a poet. I am that rage in the thunderstorm. I am that image of a thousand forms. I am magic on each page. I am a poet. I am